97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
Well, John Hyatt here. I love John Hyatt. I saw him at City Winery a few months ago, and he shared this story about having, about a year ago, having a very severe fall while hiking with his dogs, and he had a brain injury and had to kind of recover from that and learn how to play guitar over again. Not completely, but his muscle memory and his brain had to be repaired. So it was a crazy story. He's a big artist from the 80s. For those people who were around back then, maybe you know John Hyatt. Charles Lipson is with us this afternoon to talk some politics. Professor Emeritus at the University of Chicago. Charles, welcome back. How are you this afternoon? Although I don't see him there. Is he there, Ethan? I thought he was there, and
he just
because I know I pressed the button, right? Okay. Well, Charles will be here. I'll also tell you that coming up at the bottom of the hour, and we have an audio cut of the day, is Chris Elston. Chris is known as Billboard Chris online. He has been a guest on the show for 3 years. I can't even remember exactly how I discovered him, but certainly we became closer in the aftermath of Jamie Reed and the whistleblower report last year. I guess it's almost been 2 years ago now at WashU. And Jamie Reed, of course, exposed all the nonsense that was going on at WashU and the gender-affirming care clinic, the so-called gender-affirming care clinic, which is now, thankfully, closed down, which is good news. But Chris has made it his mission. And I love the way that he has framed this. He's said in the past that he's really on this mission going around the world, not just this country, to take a stand against the greatest child abuse scandal in history, which is this nonsense gender-affirming care. Well, Chris was able to go before the United Nations and do a speech a couple of weeks ago. So he's going to reflect on that and share some stories at 5:25. I think we have Mr. Lipson back. Charles, I did this amazing intro, and you didn't even hear it because the phone line dropped. But it was great. It was the best intro I've ever given to you. I just want you to know
that. Well, I deserve it. I deserve it. I'm delighted to hear it.
You know, I haven't played any of the audio from the 60 Minutes interview last night, so we might do that, you and I, together here. But I have to ask you, because I spent a good portion, if not all of my monologue this afternoon, going over this story about CBS News and Tony DeCoppel and CBS Morning News and what they did last week with Ta-Nehisi Coates. Did you see that, or are you dialed into this particular controversy?
I've only seen the clips of it, but let me take a step back and say, I think that we've reached the high water mark, and it's beginning to recede with all this kind of crazy DEI stuff. As you may know, the shorthand for DEI is didn't earn it.
Yeah, but that's true.
There is a rising tide of concern. I hear it all over the place. But I'll say one thing that may not be so obvious. When people are busy depicting themselves as victims all the time, they really hurt themselves. Even if they are victims, they hurt themselves because there's no way to succeed if you think of yourself as a victim. There's no way to get ahead.
Well, isn't that the entire Democrat Party at this point? Victimhood?
Well, I think there's a lot of victimhood. I think that it's victimhood, and you see this a lot on college campuses, a sense of guilt from people who, you know, mom is a surgeon, dad is a lawyer. What are they guilty about? How have they or their family harmed anyone? There are bad outcomes in our society, and I think that those of us who've done well ought to have some sense of responsibility, and I think that the people who've done poorly ought to have a sense of responsibility, too. There used to be a concept called the deserving poor, and which implied that some people were undeserving. But I don't understand. I think that there's a lot of the Democratic Party that's a kind of coalition of the guilty and the people who sort of proclaim themselves as victims.
So let me kind of explain this, and then we'll get to the 60 Minutes. But what happened, for those people who missed the monologue, on CBS News, Tony DeCoppel, who is one of the anchors on the morning show, did an interview with Ta-Nehisi Coates, who describes himself as a journalist, but liberal, you know, activist, whack job, who wrote a book on Israel. And this book managed to, Charles, never mention Iran. It didn't mention Hamas, none of this stuff. So Tony DeCoppel actually challenges him, right? So there's blowback from inside CBS News about Tony DeCoppola actually asking some serious questions of Coates, and they start complaining to management. Management does a conference call. It's kind of like their regular conference call, and they out Tony DeCoppola, and they actually go after him for not meeting the standards of CBS News. Now, I think I have, let me see if I can find you the soundbite here, because you have to hear what they were saying in the conference call where they said that they failed their mission.
I want to acknowledge there are a lot of times that we do this really, and then there are times we don't. And there are times we fail our audiences and we fail each other. We're in one of those times right now, and it's been growing. And now we are at a tipping point.
Now, bear with me here. Listen.
Many of you have reached out to express concerns over recent reporting, specifically about the CBS Morning's Coates interview from last week, as well as comments made coming out of some of our correspondents' reporting.
Okay, so they go on to say that that did not meet our standards. They try to say this with a straight face, that the CBS policy, Charles, is check your bias at the door. Did they not know that Margaret Brennan and Nora O'Donnell also work for CBS News? It's unreal when you hear that. And by the way, somebody leaked the whole call, so it's not supposed to be out there. It is fascinating if you take some time to listen to it.
Well, it's humiliating, or it should be, to any journalist. Somebody told me that in journalism schools, I believe they've not been able to find a single Republican on any journalism faculty of any school in the country.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. It's sad.
You went to Missouri, right?
I did. I went to Mizzou, and I'm embarrassed by what they do
in journalism. I mean, in journalism, you went to Mizzou, one of the two or three great journalism schools in the country, along with Medill at Northwestern.
That's right.
And, these schools, I mean, I can understand there's a real problem for journalists trying to find jobs in a changing environment and so forth. But, I mean, the sense that they are torch carriers for political ideology, not just the party. They're on the left wing of the Democratic Party. But that call exemplifies this sense of sort of groveling guilt for things that are not, they shouldn't be guilty about.
No,
they should be proud of those interviews.
And by the way, absolutely, and I will say this, just in case people miss this, Jan Crawford, who is a veteran journalist at CBS News, stood up for Tony DeCoppola and ripped her bosses and said, what are you guys doing here? I don't even know what the complaints are about. So that's important to notice, because there were some people that didn't feel this way. But what's interesting here is they try to, you know, on one side, they try to deny the level of bias that exists in all this other reporting. But it's very revealing that it comes out in this instance. And by the way, stating the obvious here, this conference call and all of this about this guy who doesn't mention Hamas, he doesn't want to talk about the other perspectives in Israel, in Lebanon, in Palestine. In this situation, the guy...
Brent,
what's that?
Those are freedom fighters,
right,
my
but
friend.
Charles, this all took place yesterday morning on the anniversary of this terrible attack. That's what they're discussing at CBS News on that fateful anniversary. That's even more stunning when you think about it.
But let me tell you, I have a lot of communications within the Jewish community, and people are petrified. I think that, I mean, they were in the 50s about the right wing, the Ku Klux Klan and so forth. That's not what their concerns are now. Their concerns are what is happening on Ivy League campuses.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know whether that's true at WashU and so forth, but it's not true at the University of Alabama, the University of Georgia, Tulane and so forth. So this has become a very serious problem. And part of it has to do with the nature of the coalition on campus. By the way, the Palestinians just sued the University of Chicago for discrimination. There's
of course,
no evidence
of course they did.
Whatsoever of discrimination against Palestinians. But they make common cause with African Americans, lesbians, gays, that sort of thing. That's the coalition. And because you may have seen signs, Queers for Palestine, whatever it might be, those people would be thrown off a roof in Palestine. But they can all hate Israel, so they can have a negative goal that holds them together, but they can't have a positive goal. And then there are kind of useful idiots, like we heard. But on the good side, let me say this about CBS. The interview with Kamala Harris was just brutal. And it was brutal not because they were harsh in a kind of Mike Wallace way, but that guy just asked serious, quiet questions, and she was a word salad.
She really was. And look, the other thing about that is, and this is where I have these mixed feelings about CBS, because Bill Whitaker, the guy who did the interview with Kamala, is also a guy that came. He's a veteran CBS news reporter anchor. He's the same guy that came in here a few years ago. There was another CBS reporter, Jeff Begays. They both came in at separate times. We have this. You probably follow some of this with Kim Gardner, our prosecutor, who was like Gascon in L.A.
Yeah.
You know, I call Gascon, who, by the way, is going to get booted out of office. I don't know if you've seen the polling on that. He's going to lose.
No, I haven't.
So,
I know.
Yeah. People are waking up, but he's the Kim Gardner of the West Coast, is what I say.
Right.
So, you know, you have a situation here with some of these folks that's pretty serious with just letting criminals
go. You said that they came in at the same time as Kim Gardner, but I didn't follow.
Yeah, so here's what happened. They came in here and they did reporting basically trying to, play off St. Louis as just a bunch of white supremacists. They never dug into the real issues of why Kim Gardner was controversial. They let her, you know, speak her mind about how racist people are in St. Louis. I begged them. I told Jeff Begays from CBS. We were, you know, exchanging messages. I'm like, dude, come here to St. Louis again. I'll give you Democrats that'll tell you the truth about Kim Gardner. So I just wanted to say that about Bill Whitaker. To your point, yeah, he actually did his job last night, and I was kind of surprised by that. Here's a sample.
Your economic plan would add $3 trillion to the federal deficit over the next decade. How are you going to pay for that?
Okay, so the other economists that have reviewed my plan versus my opponent and determined that my economic plan would strengthen America's economy, his would weaken it.
Pardon me, Madam Vice President. The question was, how are you going to pay for it?
Well, one of the things...
She didn't really know. I mean, I could play the rest of that, but I give Whitaker some credit, because one of the things that we've seen in both of these debates and in other interviews is nobody ever follows up. They don't press her. Okay, you give an answer. Don't move on. Follow up with a question. And he actually did that, to his credit.
I completely agree. And I thought that was, I thought there were a number of problems with the vice presidential moderators. And I thought the lack of follow-up was one. The obvious thing was wrongly correcting Vance.
Yeah, on the Springfield, Ohio stuff.
Mike, but I mean, the main point is that these people all live on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. There was a famous quote by a New Yorker film critic maybe 40 years ago, Pauline Kael. She said she didn't know how Nixon won the election. Nobody she knew voted for him. And I think that that's the problem with these networks now. There's just nobody to hold them to anything like honesty. The same is really true when you read the Washington Post, New York Times. The Times in particular is a good paper in a lot of ways, but whenever anything can be spun politically, I'm talking about hard news, what should be hard news reporting, they report it almost like an editorial.
Of course, because it's agenda journalism. And by the way, you know, my alma mater, and you mentioned Medill, these journalism schools, they're proud of this. This is how they are teaching these, you know, young students to become journalists with a capital J. They don't really care about getting all sides of the story, as many of us were taught back in the day. They care about the impact that their reporting has on making people feel equitable and safe and all this other stuff. It's just nonsense.
I completely agree. And I think in this kind of fragmented media environment that we live in today, what happens is that people have abandoned those traditional sources because that were once considered kind of neutral. Maybe they were a little on the traditional liberal side, but they believed in multiple viewpoints, and they didn't believe that their hard news was, they thought their hard news should be segregated from their editorial opinion.
Right.
And I just think that that sort of thing has gone away. You're in a you're a show that does opinion. And then you have a newscast, and the newscast is different from your opinion.
Right, but you know what? I have a better example than this, because I'm on a conservative radio station right now, and we don't make any bones about it. But, Charles, I worked for 15, 16, maybe the math is wrong, doing afternoon drive at KMOX, one of the most esteemed stations in the entire country, not unlike WBBM in Chicago or some of the other big heavy hitters out there. And I did a show from, for many years, it was 2 to 6, and then they shortened it from 2 to 5. But it was really two shows. And I've done this through much of my career. I was a news director in the past, and then I started doing talk in 1992. But what I did was, and I took this seriously, between 2 and 4, I did a talk show. My opinions were out there. Between 4 and 6, we did a news wheel. And I had a co-anchor that was with me, Carol Daniel. And I treated that period as a newsy segment. And I didn't put as much opinion in. I certainly wasn't popping off about Trump and some of these other things. Every once in a while, I'd say something. But I actually approached that and wore two different hats, which I think is possible. But you don't have two different hats anymore. You just have the one hat with many of these reporters. Now, Tony DeCoppola, in a very ironic twist here, he's the guy that actually tried to do the right thing and ask some serious questions of Coates. And then he gets laid out by his own management for being a journalist and doing the right thing.
Yeah, there are a few of them left. Some of them get fired. I'm trying to remember the woman who did the national intelligence reporting for Fox and then went over to CBS, and then they fired her, and she was terrific.
Oh, yeah, Clarissa, was it Clarissa Ward or one of the other ones?
I mean, Clarissa Ward was good, but this was a different...
I know who you're talking about. I know. We'll think about it here before the end of the segment.
But, by the way, I'm so glad you mentioned KMOX. Your listeners know I grew up in Mississippi, but we could get KMOX. And I grew up a Cardinals fan because I could listen to KMOX.
Well, you have that in common with, I always use Billy Bob Thornton as an example, because he grew up in Arkansas, and the same thing. You know, he listened to Cardinals games, became a big fan. By the way, it's Laura Logan who we were thinking about, Laura Logan.
Yeah.
That was the CBS report.
Yes, well, she too, but there's yet another, Catherine Herridge.
Oh, Catherine Herridge is great, yeah. She's at Fox
that's
now.
That's who
right.
I was thinking of.
Okay.
And she was fired.
Yes.
Or let go in a cost-cutting move or something. But she was a terrific reporter.
Right.
And very much down the middle. And she just did intelligence reporting. I mean, you can generally speaking, I'd say the Pentagon reporters are pretty down the middle. But, boy, you just hate to see. There was one of the managing editors of the New York Times who retired in maybe the 80s or something like that. And he was asked what he was proudest of, and he said, "I kept them honest."
Yeah.
And at the time, people didn't realize how important that was. They just thought, well, of course, you know, that's how it should be. But, in fact, Abe Rosenthal, and but that's what he did. And they've just abandoned that now, and maybe that's a marketing decision. But look at what's happening. You have people moving to red states where taxes are lower, regulation allows businesses to grow. Generally speaking, not always, you have competent officials, except in the cities where you have this kind of left-wing mobilization politics.
Yeah. Well, by the way, there's no better example than Chicago and Illinois. You know, I always say the people who are truly, you know, we have these discussions about voter ID, and people like to say, forcing someone to have an ID when they vote, that's you're disenfranchising voters, which is a bunch of nonsense. I always say, you know who's really disenfranchised? Anyone who lives in Illinois south of Cook County.
Oh, yeah. It's really true. And by the way, at the Democratic National Convention, you couldn't get in without an ID.
I know. That's what's amazing. Hey, listen, I got to go. We can always talk politics till the to the end of the show. But thank you so much. We got 4 weeks, Charles, 4 weeks until this election. If you had to call today, if the results are coming in tonight, what would you say?
I think Trump wins. And I think he wins because I think he wins Pennsylvania.
I know.
Whoever wins Pennsylvania, I think, is very likely to win the election.
Yeah, that's the way it seems right now. And I'm kind of, you know, Selena Zito, my friend Selena, is doing some great reporting. It is seemingly looking relatively good, but we got 4 weeks to go. Charles, have a great week. Thank you.
Great to talk to you, Mark.
Take care. right, I have an audio cut of the day still to come before the end of the hour. I think we have Kilmeade on the show tomorrow. You know, we try to hook up with Brian every week, and sometimes it's Wednesday, sometimes it's Thursday. I think he's booked for tomorrow, so we look forward to that. Right now, Chris Elston back with us. He's known as Billboard Chris online. He has gone around the planet to try to, as he says, stop the most, you know, I think the biggest child abuse scandal in the history of the modern world. Chris, how are you? Welcome back to 97.1 FM Talk.
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a busy time. I was just in Europe recently, and I spoke at the United Nations in front of the Human Rights Council. So that was a pretty big deal.
Well, that is the reason that I'm having you on. I know this was a couple of weeks ago. There's been a lot going on in the news, but I did see your video, and I was so I was proud of you that you went before the United Nations, and I watched a little of the clip. So explain what happened there, how that all came about, and what your message was, and how it was received.
Well, I was already heading to Europe for a conference, actually, in Portugal, and there was a case in Switzerland that Elon had helped go viral. I tweeted about this family, these parents who lost their daughter to the state of Switzerland. They took her into custody because the parents refused to transition her. So this was even going on in Switzerland. And I thought, well, I'm already going to Portugal. I might as well head over to Switzerland first and raise some awareness about this case, because I have this philosophy that good things happen when you go outside and put yourself out there. And as soon as I announced that I was going there, the Alliance Defending Freedom International, this fabulous legal organization who are actually helping me with my lawsuit against the government of Australia for censorship, they have an advocate at the UN, and they said they could get me to speak before the Human Rights Council. So, perfect. I did that. I had 90 seconds to speak, and it can be a bit difficult to distill this whole thing down, but I think I did an all right job. And I was also meeting with some representatives of different UN member states, including the Vatican. And the funny thing about that is, after my speech, I'd already met with this archbishop who represents the Vatican. And it was an okay meeting. He, of course, agrees that we shouldn't be doing all this stuff to kids. We shouldn't be sterilizing and maiming children and telling them that they were born in the wrong bodies. But after my speech, I had mentioned in a previous tweet, not even the main tweet, but a follow-up tweet, that I was going to be meeting with this guy. His assistant reached out and asked me to take down the tweet because I guess they just don't want the controversy. And I just thought, how absolutely shameful is that when the Catholic Church can't even admit that they had a meeting about stopping this child abuse?
And did you take it down?
I did, only because there will be more meetings coming. I'm going to be going back to the UN in March.
No, I get it. That was a diplomatic decision, right?
Yeah, and I'm going to be having a lot more meetings, and we're going to have bigger events, because the interesting thing about that was I finished my speech, and immediately when I was walking out of the room after, one of the women in the back of the room turned around and mouthed the words, "Thank you," to me.
Ooh.
And then when I was just outside that big circular room that they have, someone from another country, which I won't name, came to offer their support. They didn't know all this stuff was going on. I was down in the UN cafeteria afterwards, and some people came over, and they said it's all everyone was talking about at their table. And they were in support as well. Because just like everywhere else in the world, it's a relatively small lobby group that pushes this insanity through everywhere.
Absolutely. And it's the media. And it's the legacy media.
Absolutely. And these leftist governments. But a lot of these people at the UN, so first of all the Middle Eastern countries, the African countries, they all support me. A lot of them knew who I was, these reps.
Nice.
Which was amazing to me, but I guess it makes sense because Elon retweets my stuff once in a while. So everyone sees that. But I said to them when I was meeting with them, they said, "What should we do?" I said, "Well, I would just be bold in telling the truth because, for example, I met with the representative from Kuwait, and these Middle Eastern countries, they're constantly being told by these Western countries that they're awful for their human rights abuses. But here they have this leverage over the West where they can say, for example, you're against female genital mutilation, as you should be, as pretty much everyone is. But here you are in the West doing female genital mutilation on steroids."
That's a good point.
You're
it is a good point.
Kids.
Yeah.
You're cutting off their body parts. And you want to harangue us about our human rights abuses? Look what you're doing. So this gives them a powerful tool, I think, to push back.
I'm guessing. I never want to, you know, I'm going to assume, but I don't want to assume. You've read Tiger Reid's piece from a couple of weeks ago, right?
Yes, I did.
Jamie's husband. That is such an important piece, Chris, I think. So Jamie Reid was the whistleblower from right here in St. Louis at WashU in the gender-affirming care. But by the way, that clinic's been closed, which is good news. So she came out almost 2 years ago, 18 months ago, and, you know, puts this all out there about WashU and expresses deep concern about these kids who have mental illnesses and in many cases are just gay. And then her own partner, who's trans, writes a column a couple weeks ago and is announcing that he or she, I'm a little confused on some of this, Chris, I'm not trying to be disrespectful to them, she's detransitioning, right?
Yes, and the really interesting thing about that also was she went into the medical problems that she's having.
Yes.
So this is a woman. She's been on testosterone for several years, and boy, oh boy, those medical problems start to rack up because testosterone in the doses they're taking it does not belong in a female's body, and she's having all sorts of issues. So quite apart from her support for Jamie Reid and against the ideology itself, she went into details of a really terrible childhood that she had. And
a lot of abuse. Yeah, a lot of abuse.
Tons of abuse and awful things, which is really usually prevalent in these cases. Not always. Some of these kids have fine and normal families and they're getting indoctrinated online. But when you look at the kids who end up showing it up at these gender clinics, a ton of them have had abuse and trauma. And that was the case for her. And what we see in many of these cases is it takes several years, but they eventually realize, yeah, this isn't the solution that I had hoped it was going
to be. Really
is
an incredible piece, and I read much of it on the air a couple of weeks ago. You talked about some of the effects, you know, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, high triglycerides, sleep apnea, issue with kidneys. Now, she admits in the piece that some of those could be hereditary, but they're exacerbated by the testosterone. And, you know, she talks about her breasts and removing her breasts and how devastating that was. So that's a piece. Look, if you have a child who thinks that they're another sex, maybe they're too young to understand what Tiger Reid wrote. But that's something that parents should certainly read before they make any of these stupid decisions, I would say.
Yes, 100%. And not just the parents. A lot of the time, these kids are in state care.
Yeah.
And so because of situations like hers. So all these social workers and counselors and mental health therapists, that whole profession is pushing affirmation only on these children as though it's gender-affirming care. And the point that I made during my UN speech is there's nothing caring about sterilizing children. There's nothing caring about giving them the opposite sex's hormones, which cause all sorts of damage, including with the females, they end up having to get hysterectomies. They're sending teenage girls into menopause. And there's nothing caring about cutting off a struggling child's body parts. So the whole thing is just abuse. And we need to stop using these leftist euphemisms. And all of these state-run organizations and counselors, et cetera, they need to wake up too, because they've all been indoctrinated into pushing this as though it's somehow caring. And it's not, of course.
No, it's
and
not.
These people aren't all purely evil. They're all deceived. So we just need to keep getting the truth out there.
Well, and I will say, we'll close on this. I am embarrassed that in this country, during a presidential race, I'm not going to argue it's the most important issue, but it hasn't even been brought up because they don't want to, you know, because CBS and NBC and the New York Times, they don't want the answers out there. So they won't even ask the questions of Kamala Harris. Pretty sure I know where Trump and J.D. Vance stand on this, by the way, Chris, but the other side has not been asked.
Yes. Trump and Vance have been very clear about this. Vance was one of the only senators, actually, who was clear on this and who, before he was appointed the running mate, he wanted to pass the Protect Childhood Innocence Act, which Marjorie Taylor Greene had written, which would ban all of this and make it a criminal offense and all that. So he's always been good on this issue, so I'm very glad that Trump picked him.
Chris, you know, I think of you as a hero. I love the work you're doing on this. It's very important. You're having an impact. I think you can certainly feel that. We've been talking for a couple of years, and you've been all around the planet. So thank you so much for jumping on here again in St. Louis. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
On the Tiger Reid issue, you know, I only did this one time a couple of weeks ago, and it really is a good piece. All you have to do is Google Tiger Reid, the Free Press. It was in the FP.com. And really kind of amazing and gives a lot of history about how transition took place originally. A lot of abuse. He had a father who was a heroin addict, didn't even meet his father. Mother was addicted to drugs, went through foster care throughout his childhood or her childhood, and then, you know, thought that she was a lesbian and remembers at about the age of 7 lying in a bed wondering why she didn't have a penis. And, you know, was more of a tomboy, certainly, but then drops out of school, gets a little older, watches this series called Transgeneration, which follows this, you know, group of college students. And Tiger Reid says, well, that show was life-changing for me. It felt that it was, you know, presenting a solution in a way that she hadn't thought about, the pain of being a woman. Really, really bad experiences with periods that were very painful. All this is just devastating. But then goes into why she's making the decision to go in the other, you know, the other direction, and admits that transitioning did not bring any comfort and inner peace. In fact, just made things a lot worse. Admits that Jamie has never pressured her about detransition, but said this, that this is really Chris's point overall. The gender-affirming care model, and I would put that in air quotes, they don't hear, but I would, the so-called gender-affirming care model relies on vulnerable people's impatience, rushing them toward major medical changes rather than stopping to understand the root of their pain and suffering. And we have amongst us here in St. Louis highly esteemed individuals and professional medical people at Washington University and Children's Hospital that thought that this was okay. I mean, this is, in my estimation, I bet in Chris's estimation, some of this is criminal behavior. Criminal behavior. But they won't be charged because they were just trying to help these kids who thought they were confused, right? And she says, look, this affects not just patients, but entire families. And as Jamie Reid has shown, confused and scared parents get told falsely without transition, their kids are likely to commit suicide. That's how they scare these parents. Tiger Reid said, I'm going public because I want people like me who have complex and nuanced reasons for their gender distress to be part of the conversation. It's an important piece. And if you have anyone in your family confused about any of this, you should read it at thefp.com. We're coming back with audio cut of the day. So I did not watch it last night. I chose better. I was watching the Chiefs win their fifth game. But I did this morning, and I wanted to watch it in its entirety and not see the clips, because some of the clips from the interview with Tim Walz and Kamala had leaked out yesterday, and they weren't necessarily very good. We did get an indication yesterday that maybe Bill Whitaker was going to ask tough questions, and he kind of did, and we'll get to that here. But I watched the whole thing. They've released some edited versions of answers. Like, I'll give you an example here. So here's one of the questions. You know what? Let's just wrap this all into audio cut of the day. So we have to do this to make it official here.
Stand by. Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
Okay, so they do something like this where Bill asks a question and it sounds like this.
But it seems that Prime Minister Netanyahu is not listening.
Well, Bill, the work that we have done has resulted in a number of movements in that region by Israel that were very much prompted by or a result of many things, including our advocacy for what needs to happen in the region.
Okay, what the hell did she just say? That's Kamala word salad. She doesn't know what she's saying. She's grasping at, you know, at something that's floating around in her brain there. But here's how, you know, you could watch the whole interview, but when they released clips, it turned out a little differently here.
It seems that Prime Minister Netanyahu is not listening.
We are not going to stop pursuing what is necessary for the United States to be clear about where we stand on the need for this war to end.
Wow, they cleaned it up quite a bit there, didn't they? On the border.
There was an historic flood of undocumented immigrants coming across the border the first 3 years of your administration. As a matter of fact, arrivals quadrupled from the last year of President Trump. Was it a mistake to loosen the immigration policies as much as you did?
It's a long-standing problem. And solutions are at hand. And from day one...
Now, she tries to blah, 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 blah here. And to his credit...
I was asking was it a mistake to kind of allow that flood to happen in the first place?
I think the policies that we have been...
Okay, well, it's more blah, blah, blah. But something happened in that interview, and I can't believe I'm giving Bill Whitaker credit because I've criticized him immensely for his visits here to St. Louis covering Kim Carter. But he did something that nobody else has been willing to do, including George Stephanopoulos, and that's follow up on a question. The debate moderators, they don't answer the question. Well, of course, they did it for Trump. But follow up and say, okay, Madam Vice President, with all due respect, you didn't say anything there. So we want to know what the answer is. This is an interesting moment.
In the last 4 years...
Oh, well, let me set up the question. It was, how about all this flip-flopping on positions?
In the last 4 years, I have been Vice President of the United States, and I have been traveling our country, and I have been listening to folks and seeking what is possible in terms of common ground. I believe in building consensus.
Uh-huh.
We are a diverse people, geographically, regionally, in terms of where we are in our backgrounds. And what the American people do want is that we have leaders who can build consensus, where we can figure out compromise.
I mean, I'm going to just stop because she doesn't say anything, and it happens time and time again. Now, the best moment of audio, I have to give credit to the Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, because he really responded well. You got Kamala out there. You have another major hurricane that's moving in. And she's out there saying, well, DeSantis won't take my phone calls.
You know, moments of crisis, if nothing else, should really be the moment that anyone who calls themselves a leader says they're going to put politics aside and put the people first. People are in desperate need of support right now.
Okay, that's true. And that's what Ron DeSantis is trying to do for the people who live in Florida, and he just smacked her down.
Kamala Harris to try to say that my sole focus on the people of Florida is somehow selfish is delusional. She has no role in this. In fact, she's been vice president for 3.5 years. I've dealt with a number of storms under this administration. She has never contributed anything to any of these efforts. And so what I think is selfish
has she ever
is her trying
before?
To blunder into this. No, she has no role in this process. I'm in contact with the President of the United States. I'm in contact with FEMA director. I'm obviously managing all our state agencies. We're supporting all our local government. And I will say this, I've had storms under both President Trump and President Biden, and I've worked well with both of them. She's the first one who's trying to politicize the storm, and she's doing that just because of her campaign.
Great response from DeSantis, who's doing his job in Florida. And then one more Kamala cut here, because, you know, she went on The View this morning, too.
Welcome back, the next president of the United States.
Yeah, try not to throw up in your mouth. But this is very revealing, I think. I wonder if the voters are going to pay attention. Would you have done anything differently than, you know, the big guy that's in the White House apparently still running the show?
If anything, would you have done something differently than President Biden during the past 4 years?
There is not a thing that comes to mind in terms of, and I've been a part of most of the decisions that have had impact.
Well, that should kind of seal the deal right there if this is a change election. Nope. All good with all those decisions, including letting the border run out of control. There you go. That's our vice president doing interviews. We asked for it, and I guess we got it. We're out of time. Sue's going to be back tomorrow. Have a great Tuesday evening. Enjoy the night. Beautiful weather out there. We'll see you tomorrow at 3.
Get more at 971talk.com.